Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. A German journalist recently kayaked about 100 miles along the Great Colusa Blue Way in Lee County over the span of 9 days. Dirk Rohrbach undertook the paddle trip as part of his ongoing multimedia project called 50 States, A Journey into America. He's documenting an adventure in each state with the help of a videographer who's tagging along. Rohrbach was a physician and radio journalist in Germany. He's also published in National Geographic. WGCU's Jessica Mazzaro spoke with Rohrbach in studio just hours after he got off his kayak on February 1st. Let's hear that conversation now.
How would you describe the Colusa Blue Way for those who may have never kayaked through it?
It was a very interesting blend of totally remote areas, like the real Florida, you know, how it used to be hundreds of years ago before
and
white man came.
What does that look like compared to the other areas?
Well, you can tell by, people and development, you see structures like, complexes and houses and condos and whatnot. And then you see the beautiful, unspoiled nature, like the sandy white beaches, the mangroves. You see the blue waters, sometimes the brown waters, the marshland. You see all these beautiful animals and you see the wide open. You see the ocean, the Gulf, and you feel very small and tiny. And that contrast is what made this journey so special.
What kinds of animals did you run into, either in the water or just shore birds? What did you see?
Mostly birds, of course, but just yesterday, which was so beautiful, yesterday was pretty much the last official leg. We just had a short, tiny piece left for today, paddling to the causeway. So yesterday, just before we got into Tarpon Bay, there were two dolphins, maybe 3-4 yards away from us, swimming in circles, just having a ball in the water, leaning sideways and waving with the fins and then come back out again. And that was just so precious.
How long were you hanging out with the dolphins?
I was probably pausing for at least 3-4, maybe 5 minutes, just because I've never been to dolphins that close in the wild. And just to be out there and realize, hey, this is their environment. This is what they love to do.
Why did you choose this place? Because you're not from Southwest Florida, right?
No.
What made you choose the Blue Way?
It was a suggestion that people brought to us that we've met and encountered over the last several years, I have to say, over in Germany. They were telling us about it, and then I was looking into it. I love to travel on the water. I think it's there's a very symbiotic, very special relationship between civilization and then, of course, the water. So to be out on the water and to be in this kind of water, that was very interesting to me and very appealing. I was up north a lot, like in Alaska. I was traveling the Yukon River from the Head Lakes to the Bering Sea all the way, the entire length of it, 3 times. And ever since I did that, I felt that strong connection between us humans and the water. And we have to live together, and we challenge each other, but we cannot live without each other. And to have a completely different aspect of water travel down here, that was quite inspiring. So I was glad that we were able to come.
What made it different from your other water travels?
The towns, the cities, the development, the Yukon is unspoiled and it's wild. There's hardly anybody living there. And here you have, again, the coastline, densely populated. And then on the other side, the further out you get, the barrier islands, then there's less and less people. Sometimes there's places where you can only get to by boat. There's no road connection, so you have to use any kind of vessel to get over there. And that made it totally different, but as inspiring and as fascinating.
How would you say it sounded like? I mean, if you could describe, this is for radio, obviously. So what were the kinds of sounds that you were hearing all those days and nights? I mean,
mostly howling wind. Yesterday was the first day where the wind kind of calmed down a little bit, and then this morning as well. So you could hear more and more. You could hear the motors, of the cars going by. Of the city or towns and streets and roads. But once you're out there and just the wind's blowing and the waves are crushing around you. And then yesterday, I didn't realize how loud the dolphins actually breathe. when you're that close, and of course the water transports the waves, the sound waves, you know, many, many miles sometimes. So you would think, hey, this is a dolphin. I can hear it, but I can't see it. So that was amazing just to hear how loud that noise is.
And so we're going to go through some of the senses and continue with this
yes.
theme. What about smells? Because I know sometimes when the Calusa has been really low or if it's brownish, it's kind of a not such a nice smell, but maybe I'm just wondering what kinds of smells you encountered along the way.
There is a fishy smell, yes. There is a fishy smell from the oysters when the water's low and the mangroves are kind of exposed, the roots are. But it's not really... gross or anything. It's just different and salty. That was something. And it's the marine smell, you could say, and it was never disgusting. Of course, when you get closer to birds and where they kind of hover and sit and nest sometimes or sit and pause like in big groups, then it's getting strong. And you think, maybe I should detour a little bit. But other than that, it's just great to have these. Just like you said, you use your senses completely. And sometimes visibility was poor. I had one day when I was crossing Boca Grande, however you pronounce it, pass over mm-hmm. to the other island. And suddenly visibility was gone. Like the shoreline was there. Like 2 minutes later, it was gone. The mist was coming in. It was magical and it was threatening at the same time. So you would have to use all your other senses so you become more alert of what you hear. Is there another boat coming? Is there another engine coming close by, And then you keep your eyes peeled and suddenly the mist disappears and you see the lighthouse. That was my target again, so I hit it.
You ran into people on boats and fishermen, and did you ever interact with them, or did you kind of just wave as you went by or mind your own business? Or
we talked a little bit if we ran into people on boats. Sometimes they were just on their way to get somewhere, so there was not much chance of like conversation. But we ran into people along the way that we stayed with or hung out with or intentionally met to interview and to document their story. And we met some of the most amazing characters you could ever hope for, as a journalist or writer.
Like, can you describe maybe one person? Who's of one person that stood out to you? Or do you want to save that for your project?
No, I'm happy to share. So probably halfway through, we went to Calusa Island, just on the north tip of Pine Island, I think it is, right? And we met with Ed Chapin, who is, I guess, the ranger there of the Calusa Land Trust. And just to hear his story, like he's been living off the grid for 40 years. I think he's turning 70 this year. So he's mostly lived all by himself on that tiny little island, taking care of the land, and he was inviting us to stay. So we camped right there at the picnic area, which is not an official campsite, but it was so precious and so beautiful. And to see the sunset and come up again and just all the colors, it was like in paradise. You felt like Robinson Crusoe. And then to hear his story, how he produces electricity, how he deals with food, he has to make runs to town and come back again. But he obviously does not mind living there all alone. He said, it's good that there's not too many people here. That's why he likes it out there, and I can get it. But, just characters like him, he was so friendly, so open, so hospitable, and just so precious in a way, too, the way he cared about the land, the nature, and helps to preserve it.
And you mentioned colors. So what kinds of colors? I'm sure that it changed, as you said, like when you saw structures versus natural habitats versus sunsets. Like what kinds of colors did you see out there?
It depended on the sun a lot, and there was lots of mist going on, and then there was some cloud coverage and some pouring rain, and that made everything kind of grayish brownish. But when the sun came out and peaked high, you could see all these beautiful turquoise waters and blues, like the deepest blue you can imagine. And on that day, I was actually on the other island, Gasparillo, I think it is. And I was on the lighthouse tower looking towards Cayo Costa, the state park. And you could tell, by the color of the water where the deep channel was coming through and where it got more shallow. So and then, of course, paddling, sometimes the sun is in an angle where you can hardly tell how deep it is. And then you get closer and you realize, OK, this is more like a white yellowish, so it's sand, and then it gets brown, darker. That doesn't mean it's deeper. That's probably just vegetation under the water surface. And then you look for that bluish color that tells you, oh, this is probably clear, deep water. That's where you want to paddle to. Otherwise, you would have to get out of the canoe or kayak and just pull it for a while before you hit the deeper water.
You mentioned rain and mists. What would you say was the maybe the hardest challenge of this trip?
It certainly was the wind, and especially coming back from Gasparilla Island back to Cayo Costa in the afternoon. I knew that the wind would pick up. That's what everybody told me, so I didn't stay too long. It was in the afternoon, but the wind had already changed direction. And crossing that channel, that deep channel, that was wicked. You know, I had waves probably 5-6 feet high coming from all sides. That was the challenge. So the wind was blowing against the current and the tide, and that was creating these tremendous swells. So the little tiny 17, 18-foot kayak just bounced from one side to the other, and I was trying to keep the balance. And not looking back, just looking ahead. Here's the shoreline coming closer and closer. That was probably the biggest challenge. And then sometimes the wind from the side kind of tried to twist the kayak, and it took me some time to figure out how to use the rudder properly. But once I did, it was pretty stable, and I, you know, was able to enjoy even traveling under these rough conditions because I knew I could trust the kayak, and it wouldn't let me down, and I was safe out there.
How do you prepare for a trip like this?
You just do it. I mean, we had other people from the CVB working for us like for weeks in advance. So a big shout out and thanks to everybody involved, Nancy and Megan specifically, who've been working on that, you know, itinerary for us. They've been organizing everything so detailed with so much passion and love. That made it just easy for us to come over. And we brought our camping gear. They had organized all the kayaks, so there was nothing that we needed to research. And we just went to a grocery store, bought some food for the trip, and went out. Got a map. Here we go.
And what kind of food did you eat while you were out there?
Bad processed food. You know, we're done with it.
Is there any food that you can't wait to eat now that you're back?
Yes, I think I'm craving yogurt, fresh yogurt, and some good salad. You know, it always gets down or boils down to getting these prepackaged pouches of like pasta or rice dinners that you just. You heat the water, you just throw it in there for 5-10 minutes, whatever, and then you eat it. Not very delicious, but efficient enough to fill you up at least for some time. We brought a big glass or mug of peanut butter, extra crunchy. That's always good soul food. You can use it anywhere. In the morning, we had granola and oatmeal that we kind of blended cold with water, mixed it, and sprinkled some dried blueberries on top of it. Made some wraps for the day, got some snacks, you know, crackers, some sweets. A trail mix, of course, the essential food for a journey like that. And that kept us going. I think we didn't lose weight over that week.
You've done this kind of excursion before, right?
Yeah.
And I wonder if every time you do it, do you learn something more about yourself also?
It always confirms how much I love wide open spaces. And how much I love to interact with the people that I meet. I firmly believe that the land that you live in forms your character. And if you have people living in rough, wide open, vast land, these people tend to be more self-sufficient, adventurous, free-spirited, maybe a little bit, but also very hospitable, helpful, and kind. And they take you in, they take care of you because they know once you're out there in the rough, you need that help. And maybe tomorrow it'll be yourself. So you better take care of that. Even if it's a stranger, you just take them in. And I really enjoy that. So it seems like a land that's wild, rough, and untamed is kind of pulling me in every time. So I'm looking for places like that. And I found it actually right here in Florida as well.
And how do you adjust back to kind of regular life after these kinds of trips?
Not at all. So I was able to kind of transform my life about 8 years ago. I was a physician. I worked for public radio in Germany. And I loved it, and I still love it and miss it in a certain way. But traveling has always been a big part of my life, so I decided to make it my life. And 8 years ago, I became a full-time nomad. I quit all my jobs. I don't have a permanent home anymore, so I bounce back between the U.S. and Germany. Usually in the summer, I travel over here. So this is just the kickoff for another long travel season. So I'll be back in about 6 weeks or so and spend the entire summer in America.
And what do you plan to do with this footage and these experiences that you've encountered the last few days?
So the first thing that's going to happen, and since we're talking, I will produce a 15-minute radio feature for public radio in Germany. So all the interviews that I collected, all the sound bites that I got, I will listen to, of course, and then kind of put into a radio piece, also a podcast that will be downloadable. I have a long-term project called 50 States, A Journey into America. It's probably going to take me 5 years at least to cover all 50 states, even though I've been to most of them. But for this project, I will visit each and every area again, even the ones that I haven't been to. I mean, have been to before. So this will be part of that 50 States project, which would be a picture book, a big one, a paperback also. We'll have a series of speaking engagements over in Europe. So we're going to share the story and the encounters that we had over here. Multimedia blogs, you name it. You know, there's all these different outlets, and we're totally excited about it.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate you coming in today, especially since you were fresh off of the kayak. So
can you smell the salty water still on? No, thank you so much for having me. That was a blast.
That was German journalist Dirk Rohrbach speaking with WGCU reporter Jessica Mazaros about his recent 9-day kayak trip through the Great Colusa Blueway in Lee County. The journey was part of a multimedia project he's conducting by traveling to and adventuring in all 50 states in the U.S. Rohrbach provided the sound of wind and waves for this segment. To view some photos from his trip, visit WGCUnews.org. We're going to wrap up this hour with an answer to a question submitted to us through our Curious Gulf Coast project, where we invite listeners to ask questions about Southwest Florida. A woman named Rose asked us to, quote, please tell her about the factory on Fort Myers Beach, which harvested coquina clams and used them to cook, can, and sell clam chowder. So we reached out to the IMAG History and Science Center in Fort Myers, and they sent over a man named Jim Powers to give us some insight. WGCU's Mike Canary sat down with Mr. Powers. Let's hear that chat now.
My name is Jim Powers, P-O-W-E-R-S.
And what is your title there?
I am the historian.
We got this listener question about this Fort Myers Beach coquina clam factory. And when we first got it, none of us had heard of it. And so we weren't sure, you know, how much truth there was to it. Is this something that you had come across long ago? Is this part of local lore?
It's not lore. It's extremely factual. However, associated with it is a great deal of entertainment and subsequent lore. The factory existed.
And it existed where?
It existed at Connecticut and Estero. Now, Connecticut is the street that runs to the Mound House, if the locals know where that is. So this factory was literally at that intersection, Connecticut and Estero Boulevard.
So is that where the casino was? Or explain the connection to the casino.
Well, there's actually a very interesting connection with the casino because it was the brainchild of Captain Jack Delisle. Well, Captain Jack was, to say the best, formerly of Her Majesty's military service. And he appeared around 1920 down here. And there's no bridge into Crescent Beach. And Crescent Beach, of course, is now known as Fort Myers Beach. And so being the entrepreneur that he was, and I have quotes around that too, he funded through investment and built the first bridge across to Estero Island.
And what would the time frame be on this?
1920-21.
Okay.
Okay. So he starts developing subdivision, restaurant, oceanfront facilities, et cetera. So his highlight, his centerpiece is the casino. The casino will open next month. Well, have you ever been into a tavern with the sign ahead of right behind the bar that says free beer tomorrow?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's Captain Jack. And so he had some buildings, and a local person said, "Hey, Jack, give me a little money and so forth, and we'll create a clam factory." And that's how it all started.
And these are the Coquina clams, which are the little tiny clams.
Itty bitty
like
little.
Like a little half inch long.
Itty bitty little
all
things.
Different colors.
Exactly.
And so how on earth did that get turned into something?
Well, I think some of that entrepreneurial spirit that Captain Jack brought probably played a pretty good part in it, because the little teeny tiny Coquina clam also carries with it most often a clam worm. I'd imagine that's not too tasty.
Mm-hmm.
And they certainly can't be like eaten with a fork or anything. I mean, they're just they're you know, penny size. So local residents would gather them up and take them to what was a casino support building. At the time, of course, it wasn't a casino. But at this support building, and Jack invested in it by not charging rent and so forth and shared in the profit. And so they would bring it in, and the factory would literally render it into a broth.
Mm. They weren't opening up the individual Coquina clams.
Absolutely not.
They were just putting it all in a pot and making a broth.
Yeah, they didn't have enough thimbles and needles to open them up. So in the end, they would can that mixture. Now, one of the entertaining things is that that particular broth was advertised as a hangover cure. That was the big thing. Though I imagine the broth was probably pretty good. You know, we use clam juice today. So the long and short of that one is that when the war came along, the World War II, they went out of business. Very simple. You know, we were now the arsenal of democracy. And consequently, the tin goes to the arms industry. And you can't have canned clam juice without having cans. And that was the end of it.
So it made it 20 years or so?
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
That was WGCU's Mike Canary talking with historian Jim Powers from the IMAG History and Science Center in Fort Myers about the Coquina Clam Factory that did actually once exist on Fort Myers Beach. If you'd like to ask your own Curious Gulf Coast question, go to WGCUnews.org and click on Curious Gulf Coast. That's all the time we have for the show today. It was produced by Mike Canary and Rachel Iacovone. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.